Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talked to Brett Wright, who is the film editor of Split Tooth Media and is something of an expert on American independent cinema. What does that have to do with Guelph, you're wondering? Well, in 1982, John Cassavetes, who has long been considered the godfather of the modern American independent film movement, appeared in a schlocky Canadian-made horror movie called The Incubus, and a not-so-small portion of The Incubus was shot right here in Guelph. Just in time for Halloween, we are going to talk about that time in the 80s where an Academy Award-nominated actor and director came to Guelph to hunt monsters in an unforgettably forgettable horror movie. A Hollywood moment in Guelph is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast.
Galen Village. Tranquil. Quiet. A nice place to live. But something has gone wrong.
Look at the bruises on the kid's neck. One hell of a large hand. His spine was crushed like a piece of balsa wood.
When the sun goes down, something stalks the streets of Galen Village.
Joe wants to call the Attorney General, have him send in some help. What do you think I should do?
Take whatever help you can get.
30 years ago in Galen, these same types of murders occurred.
I think my past has something to do with these murders.
No, Tim, listen.
It is real. It is alive. It is among us. The Incubus.
Now that was a bit from the trailer for The Incubus, and it was released in 1982. The story focuses on a small New England town which is plagued by a series of rapes and murders. Cassavetes plays Sam Cordell, a doctor who's just moved to town with his estranged daughter and gets wrapped up in the police investigations of the attacks. Meanwhile, his daughter Jenny is dating a boy named Tim, whose family has a very long history in the town going back to its founding, and he's having nightmares that not so coincidentally coincide with each attack. As the saying goes, it's not Shakespeare, and it easily uses the word sperm more than just about any script ever written. But it's hard to deny that there's something about The Incubus. For Guelphites, it might be the glimpses of vintage Guelph circa 1980. Great portions of the film were shot downtown, in the old Odeon Cinema along Douglas Street, and for one particularly lengthy scene where Dr. Cordell drives down McDonald Street and through the intersection at Wyndham. Scenes were also shot at Homewood, the Gilnockie House on Queen Street, and the Alora Gorge, where the film's memorable opening was set. The shoot was unsurprisingly well documented by locals, and why not? Because you didn't have to be a film nerd to know the work of John Cassavetes. He was nominated for a Best Director Oscar in 1974 for A Woman Under the Influence, and he was nominated for the Best Supporting Actor Oscar in 1968 for The Dirty Dozen, in which he played Victor Franco. In a way, shooting something like The Incubus seemed like a step down for Cassavetes. That same year, he directed Gloria, which scored his wife Gina Rowlands an Oscar nomination and scored him a Golden Lion at the Venice Film Festival. So what artistic rewards were there for Cassavetes in coming to Guelph to hunt monsters? This is where Brett Wright comes in. Wright wrote an article for Split Tooth Media about Cassavetes and why a man that struggled making horror films under talents like Roman Polanski and Brian De Palma would find some creative solace in shooting The Incubus. This week on the Guelph Politicast, Wright will give us some insight into the artistic value of The Incubus for Cassavetes, why this supposedly forgettable horror movie from the early 80s hasn't been forgotten, and why modern audiences and horror fans have been giving it a second look. We will also talk about The Incubus as a time capsule for Guelphiness, and for the requisite Guelph connection, it does turn out that Wright's dad was born in Guelph, and we will also talk about Canada as a pressure cooker for great horror cinema. So I caught up with Brett Wright earlier this week via Zoom. So Brett Wright, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
First of all, to sow your Guelph bona fides, and I didn't know this when I reached out to you, your dad is from Guelph.
Yeah, he was born there. And actually, I asked him right before I called you. He was born in Guelph, then he moved to Brampton, and then my grandparents took him over to Oregon when they moved to the States. So, you know.
Wow.
They might have left him if they had the choice, but. Yeah.
So how old was he when he left Guelph?
Oh, man. I think he was still a baby.
Okay.
Yeah, he moved, I think he was 9, something like that, when he made it to the States. Maybe 6. I think it was 69. He was born in 63. Yeah, so I think he was 6.
Yeah, so we're setting, just to set a baseline, now that we expect no great Guelph anecdotes from you, we can focus on...
Sorry, I don't have a lot. Yeah.
we can focus on the movie itself. And I guess, first of all, because this is kind of your area of interest in writing about film, like American independent film, people may recognize the name John Cassavetes. They may recognize the face because he was in stuff like The Dirty Dozen. But in terms of like his significance to independent cinema in America, can you just add a little sort of color commentary and just like how big a figure John Cassavetes is?
Yeah, so Cassavetes made a film called Shadows in 1959. That's when his final cut of it came out. And that was a film that a lot of people saw and inspired a lot of, you know, Martin Scorsese was just maybe the biggest example. But he kept making films. He tried working in the studios and it didn't work too well. And he eventually shot his second independent feature, Faces, which came out in 1968, which was a film he shot mostly with friends who were actors. He shot most of it in his house, in his mother-in-law's house. And it was something he worked on for years. It was, every film he did on his own was just the ultimate form of, passion projects. And he often didn't make a lot of money from these films, and they were struggles. He'd have to, mortgage his house. There's a story of him having to literally break a piggy bank when Jenna Rollins was pregnant and telling her, I'll just deliver it myself, because they needed money to finish editing a film. And he would do movies as an actor to kind of make money for his own projects. Some of those were more high profile, something like Rosemary's Baby, for instance, which along with Dirty Dozen is probably the one he's most famous for, where he plays Guy Woodhouse, the husband who might have sold, the movie's a little ambiguous, but he might have sold his wife's newborn son to the devil. He also was in, multiple television shows. He has a great episode of Columbo where he is a villain. I think he's a murderous orchestra conductor, and he just steals the whole episode. But he would often do these movies for the paycheck to pay for his own projects, and The Incubus is one of those. So...
Was there a lot of money in making The Incubus? I mean, I guess because he was kind of the name in the cast. But I mean, it was a small production, wasn't it not?
Yeah, very small. And I think what attracted him to The Incubus was the top billing, and he figured he could have a little more say in who he could work with. And one of the biggest choices he made regarding that was getting John Huff, who he had worked on in the late 70s. He made a movie called Brass Target with him, which is sort of like a speculative World War II film where he's investigating a plot against General Patton. It's not as interesting as it sounds, unfortunately. But the first time he worked with him, and he liked working with him. And John Huff had experience in horror films. He had, just a few of the better ones he made. He made a film called Twins of Evil, which is I actually just watched that a few days ago. That's a very interesting one with Peter Cushing's. And he also made Watcher in the Woods, which used to scare me to death when I was little, when it would play on the Disney Channel. He liked working with John Huff, and he was able to get him on board. And I think he recognized that having it be a smaller production, he might be able to make it more enjoyable for him and more exciting than his other films that he had done as sort of, hate using the term paycheck movies, but those type of productions.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he kind of persuaded the production to hire Huff. It was kind of that situation where he had some say in who was going to direct.
Yeah, yeah, he was able to get Huff on. And there are different ideas on how this came about, but there were script revisions. And, you know, Carrie Keene, who plays Laura Kincaid in the film, she says that Cassavetes and Huff together would write, like rewrite scenes day of almost, you know, and kind of do things kind of on the fly. And she liked that environment. She said the environment on the film was, you know, very much something where it was more creative and everybody kind of had room to work. But then John Huff doesn't remember it that way. And he says it was mostly Cassavetes who did it, which I find interesting. But I know Cassavetes did like working with Huff. And I think a lot of it had to do with Huff wasn't necessarily somebody who just stuck to the script. He was willing to, you know, give actors some say, take some chances. Huff even talks about one of his, there's an interview on the fantastic Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray disc of this with John Huff. And he talks about his way of shooting was he would try and, I kind of love this. He would dream the scene before he would like think of it before he went to sleep and he'd dream it. And then he'd show up on set and he'd go, well, this is what I dream. So we're going to do, he said he'd do three different takes. He'd do his, then he'd do one for the actors. And then they kind of work together to figure out what worked best for the third. And then they would kind of figure out which one was the best fit in the editing process. And that is definitely something I could see Cassavetes appreciating.
I mean, hearing you explain that, it paints quite the picture of why you get the finished film that you do. And when you watch The Incubus, there are some scenes where, the actors, God bless them, were taking it like super seriously. even the stuff coming out of their mouth was just ridiculous. And I think I saw like a Letterboxd review where somebody said like, this has to be the Guinness record for like the most times a script uses the word sperm.
Yes.
and to hear that too, that it was a collaborative atmosphere. The director was dreaming scenes, and you do get a feeling of that. And I think perhaps for years this has been painted as kind of this schlocky kind of 80s horror thing, but there is some real creativity to some of the shots. And I think of one in particular, the scene in the farmhouse where the family is killed and one of the daughters is in a wheelchair, and there's the scene where the camera is kind of placed under the wheelchair and she's going down the hallway, comes to the bathroom door, turns, and the camera is at level so you can see under the doorway and you see the other sister's body on the floor. And I'm like, somebody was really creative on the set here. This is not, there is some good stuff you could pull for film class here.
Yeah, I mean, Huff knew what he was doing. Like he could make some good horror movies. I mean, Twins of Evil, I'll plug that one again. That one I would recommend. And to bring up you brought up the sperm count for how many times they've mentioned that. There is a pretty funny story about one of the scenes that they were shooting when apparently Cassavetes and John Ireland, I think they might have worked together in TV before because I think they got along very well, though. Apparently there was a scene where Cassavetes' character has to use the term three-pronged sperm, and he couldn't say it. Like, he just couldn't do it. And he and John Ireland just kept giggling like, you know, little schoolboys throughout the whole thing. And John Huff pretended to be furious and like called for lunch, ended the shoot for the time being. And they went off like, oh man, he's really mad. We got to get this together. And sure enough, John Huff was just messing with him. He'd actually cut the scene. So he just cut the line or whatever. So that's one less mention of that word. So there you go.
John Huff, I found, because I wasn't too terribly aware of him. But, I mean, he has this interesting career where he does these big horror, not big in terms of scale, but, you know, these horror movies. But he also, you know, at this time was coming out of doing like Disney films, like kids films. Like he did an adaptation of Treasure Island and he did the original Escape from Witch Mountain.
That's right. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah. He seems like an interesting figure. Like, what's his story?
You know, I wish I could tell you more. I know he studied at an academy. I want to say it was like an academy in England where it was like him and only a select few young, kind of up and coming, promising filmmakers got to basically act as apprentices for sort of more established people. Like I think he mentioned, I think he got to work with David Lean. I wish I could give you dates and actual films that he worked on. But he was in sort of that program, and then that made way, I'm sure, Twins of Evil, 71, working for Hammer, like a lot of American filmmakers, you know, I'm sure it's kind of, for him, it was kind of like going to AIP or something, and working in that. And then he would get the bigger projects like Brass Target, which, not as interesting, definitely a bigger budget. You know, he's got Sophia Loren, he's got Robert Vaughn. But, you know, I think he definitely works better when he has a little less pressure to impress in the budget sense, you know, make the big spectacle movies. Because Twins of Evil and even Watcher in the Woods, that one still kind of holds up. It still can be a little scary, you know, for a kid's movie.
Yeah, it's interesting to note, you know, a lot of these guys came up, you know, in Britain, it was kind of Hammer. In the United States, a lot of directors came out of Roger Corman's, you know, studio and working with that, you know, these kind of films, not to say breeding ground as a negative way, but it is kind of like a breeding ground where a lot of really great directors learn their skill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And it's funny because I was actually just thinking about this because I wrote on the film Messiah of Evil. I don't know if you've seen that. And you know, it's worth seeing it. The people Willard Hoyk, I think is how you say his name, and Gloria Katz, who were nominated for an Oscar for American Graffiti and then also wrote and directed Howard the Duck. But their first feature that they co-directed and wrote was this small sort of Lovecraftian horror movie. And they talked about that in one of their interviews. Like, yeah, no, you go through the horror thing. That's how you kind of, it's like a stepping stone. You go and then you move on to the bigger stuff. But with someone like Huff, when he comes back and does Incubus 10 years after Twins of Evil, you know, it's like, why does this need to be a stepping stone? This is, you know, he's doing some really interesting stuff here. You know, kind of wish certain people would stay in that realm of horror movies. You know, it would be interesting to see how certain careers would have turned out.
Right, and that seems to be something, to bring this up to modern day, there's something more allowable, I guess, because there's been this trend, you know, you think about people like Jordan Peele or Ari Aster, where, you know, they can make really great horror movies, but people don't necessarily go, oh, that's just a horror movie. People regard them as, like, just good movies on their own right that sometimes even get Oscars.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting how it's changed and how, you know, I don't know, I'm not the biggest fan of a lot of those movies. You'll get me complaining about A24 fanboys all the time. Don't put that in the podcast. They'll come after me. But, you know, it's interesting to see how horror has kind of become this like prestige. You know, we had somebody write about, the idea of elevated horror, which I hadn't even heard of. And she's kind of going like, you know, well, why do we have to call it this when we can just consider them on their own terms as good movies. But, you know, and it's something where a lot of people see these movies that are doing, you know, they're horror films, but they're following more of like a, you know, I hate using this word, but it's something that comes up a lot, like more of like a literary tradition and, you know, like these big budget things that are more geared towards, you know, like something that you would see winning a screenplay Oscar or something. When I think a lot of the best horror films are the ones that kind of get rid of that form and kind of give you something that you can't really catch your bearings in. It's not familiar. And the Incubus sure has a few of those moments where you're just like, what is going on here? You know? So.
Well, now that we know that it was a three-pronged assault of acting exercise, dream analysis, but you'd make an interesting point because I think this happens with horror movies more often than other types of movies, where there is, like, years afterwards, there is a reassessment of some of these. You know, one of the biggest ones is probably Carpenter's The Thing, where all of a sudden everyone was talking how great it was, the genius it was, and it tanks in 82 when it comes out. The Incubus is not quite on that scale, but there has been kind of a reassessment in recent years, hasn't it? People have been revisiting it for some reason.
I wish I knew more about like what people like when it happened, but I revisited it when it came out on Blu-ray, when it was released by Vinegar Syndrome here. That was 2018, I believe. And, you know, because when it first came out, I don't know if you've read some of the reviews. They were pretty funny. Vincent Canby, what did he say? It was like, these movies aren't entirely bad. You know, they employ a lot of people.
Yes.
Which is, yeah, I don't read his stuff a lot, but I think that's a pretty good one. But yeah, people just thought it was disgusting. And they thought, you know, Cassavetes was terrible. And but now people kind of watch it and... there's a little more information about how it was made, and so you get a little more backstory into how, the thought process behind Cassavetes' performance, and especially knowing how he approached a lot of his roles in other horror films. You know, because he did like, you know, not that he did a lot of them, but for instance, he did De Palma's The Fury, which is a movie I don't think I'd recommend to anybody. I know it has its fans, but. You know, he was so bored making that movie because it was such a standard script, and you know, he wasn't a fan of horror films at all, and so he had to make these choices in his performance, where he would, you know, in his most menacing scenes, he would use a really soft voice, like in that last scene, that everybody's seen in a GIF, you know, of his head exploding, and he just put his arm in a sling to give him something to work with because he was so bored during the production. But then with, you know, something like the Incubus, we can see similar thinking behind some of his choices and just these odd touches he gives to his role. Like I watched it last night, and, the one that caught me this time was when the librarian is being wheeled out on the stretcher after she's been murdered and she's got the sheet on her, and he's like, you know, he knows she's dead, but he lifts the sheet and then just oddly takes her pulse, even though she's dead. And he like feels like the flesh of her neck and like in just the strangest way, and he just has these little mannerisms that he does that just kind of make you go, oh, what was that, you know? And so that I feel like knowing more about kind of what he was trying to do with horror might have helped make something like The Incubus be reassessed in a more positive light.
Speaking of The Fury, I'm not sure even that documentary about Brian De Palma, the one that came out a couple of years ago, I'm not sure that The Fury was even mentioned in that. Like, they didn't really address it at all, I don't think.
Oh, really? I never saw that, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's not something I'd be necessarily proud of if I was Brian De Palma. But,
I mean, fair enough. It just, I don't remember I don't have a photographic memory of the film, but it seemed like they kind of glossed over it. It went from Carrie to Scarface. But which may be the right call, as you said. But talking about Cassavetes' mannerisms in this, do you think he was sort of like conscious of, speaking of The Fury and Rosemary's Baby, probably like his two biggest contributions to horror aside from this, you know, he was essentially playing villains in that movie. And he has, not to say that, or cast aspersions about his physical appearance, but he's... not traditionally handsome, Hollywood handsome, shall we say. But he, you know, he has that certain look. He has that sort of devil may care kind of look to him. And do you think that maybe he was playing off that a bit, that people come into this and maybe see Cassavetes and maybe instinctually expect him to be villainous in some regard? But even though in The Incubus, he ends up kind of being the hero.
Yeah, it's funny because I think most of the cast were surprised that he wasn't the villain too. You know, I think it was John Huffy was like, "Yeah, I saw the final edit," and was like, "Oh, I thought it was going to be Cassavetes." And also, you know, because Incubus are, you know, in the legends, they're generally males, and then Succubus, you know, it's a, you know, and all of a sudden it's a female, is the Incubus. All of a sudden it's like,
spoiler alert.
You know, yeah. Oh, sorry. You can cut that if you want to. But I figure everybody in Guelph has seen this classic, right?
They should. Sort of, yeah.
But yeah. But yeah, I think he definitely went into this knowing that he could cast that kind of feeling over the film, and you know, because he's definitely the scariest person in this movie, and I think that's intentional, because he's, I'm trying to think if there was any connection to the Fury performance, but like he would always, like in that film, like I said, just make those odd choices, even when he's kind of like, because I think at first you think he's a good guy because he's meeting with the Kirk Douglas character. And but even then he just comes across as this, you know, obviously, you know, he's a villain. But yeah, in this, I definitely think he was playing off his, because he could make that, you know, somebody compared him to like a shark. He has those like shark eyes, I think is what one critic said about him in a movie. And I believe he would know to play that up in a horror film.
Do you know if they, and maybe this is a matter of sort of folklore around the film, they didn't know how to end it, right? They were making that up as they go.
I mean, that's what I gather, especially hearing John Huff didn't even particularly know that Cassavetes was going to be the villain. Or it wasn't going to be the villain, I'm sorry. It sounds like they were pretty much rewriting scenes day of, kind of like playing with it, and they left a lot of room, a lot of freedom to kind of change things up. And everybody, in the interview with Carrie Keene I've seen, she talks about how it was just like this really interesting collaborative experience working together with everybody, kind of pitching in their own ideas, seeing which ones work. And it seems like they did kind of keep it open to how it would end.
Not to spoil it, but, you know, there is...
I've already done that twice.
You've already done it twice. But, you know, in avoiding, like, every detail of the ending, it really does feel like it runs out of steam to an extent. When they finally sort of confront the kid who's having the nightmare visions, and it's kind of been painted that he's the one that's been behind this the whole time, and they have this kind of, I don't know, intervention for him. It does feel like the film is kind of crawling to an ending that they don't know what it is.
Yeah, that's when they bust out the monster, too. You finally get to see
yes.
him, you know, for a split second. You know, I would agree. You know, I should be clear, this is not a perfect movie. You know, I made sure to do this when I wrote about it. Like, just want to be clear, you know, I don't want people to think I'm putting this up there with, you know, Mikey and Nikki or anything that Cassavetes acted in that's, you know, among the greatest performances ever done in American film, you know. But I think that this movie definitely has its issues, and I think towards the end it kind of gets to the point where maybe they left it a little too open to go its own way and kind of lost track of it a bit, maybe.
You did mention that they do show an incubus monster at some point, and you can go back and you can look at the original poster for this, and it is like kind of very 80s. It shows this monster that's not really terribly specific. It's like a piece of like art that was designed pre-production, but it's this monster carrying this woman. And you do see, and of course a lot of people interpret this as kind of like the quote unquote artistic way to do this, where you see bits of the monster. There's the scene in the washroom where you see the monster's arms grab the girl under the door. Mm-hmm. But you don't see the full monster regalia till the very end. Again, that seems like kind of an artistic choice, but it also sounds like nobody really knew there was going to be an incubus in the incubus.
Yeah. I can see that being a thing. I don't know much about that, personally, but I can totally see them adding that, like, oh, well, we kind of need to do something
now. We kind of need an incubus.
Yeah. I do love that poster. The first time I saw it, I was like, oh, you know, it's like the spaceman, right? I thought it was going to be like, oh, it's an outer space movie or something where he like lands in a lake and attacks a bunch of, you know, co-eds at the beach, you know. But then it turns out to be something completely different. So, you know.
It is kind of funny how all of these elements came together, and some of them are just not in the movie at all. I wanted to get your opinion too, as a film writer. And this is something I've toyed with for years, is that, you know, Canada as a place typically thought of, and I know a lot of Americans think about us this way, as, you know, very quiet, unassuming, beer loving, what have you, the Mackenzie brothers image. But Canada is home to a lot of really granted, Huff and Cassavetes weren't from Canada, but it's not surprising to me that this was made in Canada. This was a Canadian film Because, you know, especially lining it up, and this may be high praise, but, you know, Black Christmas, which was sort of the prototypical slasher movie in a lot of respects, you know, that is a Canadian film too. It just seems like we have some dark thoughts up here.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to bring as soon as you mentioned, you know, I was going to bring up Black Christmas because I consider that to be one of the scariest movies I've ever seen. Yeah, you guys have some dark stuff. Well, what's going on up there? You guys all right? I thought it was bad down here, but
well, it's, you know, you're from Portland, so you're one to talk. it just also strikes me too. It's like sort of so far as monsters go, we don't get not a lot of attention is paid to the incubi and the succubi in pop culture, as like say werewolves or vampires. But you know, the two most prominent products featuring those creatures, the incubus and Lost Girl, which I don't know if you've ever seen Lost Girl, but it was a Canadian show that was, I know it was on Sci-Fi in the States, but the heroine in that film is a succubus. It's kind of this weird, thing that, again, a weird Canadian thing that, you know, the two products that are like sort of associated with these sex monsters are Canadian too. So that's another aspect I find interesting. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but
unfortunately I don't know much about succubi and incubi. Not my expertise, but, I'm interested. I'll check out this Lost Girl show.
You might like it. It's very Canadian.
any other good Canadian horror movies I should check out, by the way? Not to take up your time.
I'm sure we can come up with a few. Off air, of course. Maybe to wrap up, do you think Cassavetes, I mean, he passed away in 89, unfortunately, but would, you know, what would he think of these kind of examinations of, like, certain aspects of his career like this? Like, what do you think he would think about, you know, people rediscovering Incubus, given one of the reasons he took it was for a certain degree of Canadian film, creative freedom. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what do you think he would think about people coming up to him today and saying, Mr. Cassavetes, I loved you in The Incubus, or I just rewatched The Incubus and you were great, you know, would he sort of have an appreciation for that?
I don't know. He was a difficult one. I think you'd have to catch him in the right mood. From what I know, it could go either way. I don't know. I feel like he might. I'm sure, you know, he would have fond memories of making it. I don't know how he'd feel about. I don't think you'd ever see him at a horror convention. I think. For the most part, if he were alive to see this movie come about, he'd probably be more than a little dismissive of it. And but you know, I know he wasn't a fan of his other horror films that he lived to have to answer questions about.
I got this from your article too. I mean, a lot of that had to do with his experiences. He was not a fan of working with De Palma or Roman Polanski.
Mm-hmm. No, that is true. But he also was somebody who was really not, he did not approve of violence in his films. Like, for instance, he had one of his movies is The Killing of a Chinese Bookie, and he actually had to shut down the shoot the day that they were supposed to film the killing of...
the titular killing.
Yeah, and because he was actually very concerned with depicting that on screen. He didn't like violence, and he was wondering, like, oh, should I do this? And I know, like, he's spoken out about, you know, I can't think of specific films, but he was not a big fan of Stanley Kubrick's work, and I imagine Clockwork Orange would be the first one you'd look at. He did not see violence. You know, he was, you know, the Pauline Kael loving Bonnie and Clyde stuff. He was not a fan of that type of filmmaking. You didn't see that as particularly, you know, I don't want to say provocative. I think he just saw it as exploitive. Because his movies, you know, his whole theory or his whole idea was like, I don't deal in violence. I deal in emotional violence. And have you seen his films? Any of them?
Yeah, I've seen a couple of them. I've seen Gloria and a couple of others.
Okay. Gloria is actually one of his studio ones, so I'd be interested to know what you think of some of his others if you get a chance. But, you know, he was one of those guys who always wanted to be asking the hardest questions. He wasn't afraid of confrontation and pushing people, you know, which is why I wonder how his conversations with horror fans would have gone if they would have come up telling him they loved this, you know, kind of slasher horror film he was in. Yeah, he was very much not a fan of that kind of filmmaking. But again, you know, who knows? He had such a good time making it, it sounds like, that he might have some good anecdotes if you walk up with a poster to sign. So
I am curious if he had any good anecdotes about Guelph, because it does seem like he spent a lot of time here.
Yeah, oh, I bet he'd have some. Yeah, apparently they'd after shoots, he'd take everybody out for dinner. And they would just have, I don't know if you, have you seen Woman Under the Influence? That film? Okay, there's this very famous scene in there, the spaghetti breakfast, where Jenna Rowland's character has all of her husband, Peter Falk's work buddies over for breakfast, and they all have this giant get-together, everybody's singing and performing for each other, and it sounds like they would have dinners that were kind of like this, where the wine would get flowing and everybody be having fun, and he would also do script readings in his hotel room. And Carrie Keene, actually, he invited her over the weekend. He had Ben Gazzara and Jenna Rowlands come to town and stay in his hotel room. They read Woman of the Influence in his hotel room, and Carrie Keene got to play the part of Mabel in front of Jenna Rowlands. Sounds like she mentioned this in the Vinegar Syndrome interview. So yeah, he liked to get people creating, and you know, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's people who are listening to this who are Guelphites probably hear a lot of stuff that probably makes them think he probably was right at home here, and I think they would probably be right. So it's too bad there isn't any kind of record somewhere of his Guelph thoughts, but
yeah.
We could certainly imagine he enjoyed his time, or I guess we certainly hope he did. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Brett Wright, thank you so much for your time and your insight today. And if you ever want to come to Guelph, maybe we can arrange some sort of Incubus location tour. Because you might be surprised how similar the town still looks from some. I mean, the names have been changed, but the layout of the town is still pretty much the same.
I would love that. That sounds fantastic.
All right, we'll set it up.
Yeah, and thank you for having me. This was a blast.
Thank you. And once again, that was Brett Wright. You can read Wright's piece, An Artist's Nightmare, John Cassavetes' Horror Films and the Incubus, on Split Tooth Media. Guelph Museums also has photos that were taken on the set of the Incubus here in Guelph, and you can find them in the Guelph Museum's digital collection. And you can watch the Incubus itself for free on the ad-supported streaming site Tubi TV, and you can find that at TubiTV.com. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is usually recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, or you can download it from the host Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson or at Guelph Politico. You can go to Guelph Politico on Facebook, which you can find at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.